Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a 7-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. So I took a couple weeks off because I had that cold that everyone else has been having. Jumping right back into it with a lung cancer survivor, a friend of Katie Dewey Brown, who is my friend at Longevity. This is Melissa Krause. She is a lung cancer survivor, and she's going to be talking to us today. How are you today, Melissa?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, Mel. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. I hope to see you at the Hope Summit, but like I said, I got some things going on, so I'm not sure about this year, but hopefully next year. But let's dive right in. Let's talk about when you were diagnosed and go on from there.
Okay. I was diagnosed in late August of 2005. It was an accidental finding because I needed to have a physical when I moved to Florida and accepted a teaching job here in Florida. I moved here from Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area, and I needed to have a physical done. And it was during that physical that the doctor discovered that I had lung cancer.
How did he discover that?
Well, I needed to have a tuberculosis test, and I was having a little cough that I just chalked up to allergies. And so for the TB test, he opted for an X-ray as opposed to the skin test. And that's when they discovered a nodule in my upper left lobe. So I had lung resection, followed by the standard course of treatment at the time, carboplatin and Taxol, which is what everybody seems to get the first time around. And then I was fine for a few years, but it came back in my liver. So I'm actually have been and still am a stage 4 cancer patient, and I'm currently on a clinical trial.
But you're stage 4 since 2009, which is pretty amazing.
That's what I'm told. That's what I'm told. But it's been discovered that I have the RET mutation, and the clinical trial I'm on now is designed to target that mutation, which the doctor, the specialist I see, says is driving my cancer, is the RET mutation.
And how did they find? How did they?
A lot of happenings and a lot of progress being made in the field, but it's not being made fast enough. Still, it's catching up, but there's still a long way to go.
And how did they find that mutation? What sort of test did they do?
Well, I sought out a specialist. It's a long story how this came about, but I ended up with a lung cancer specialist at Mass General in Boston. And Dr. Jeffrey Engelman, and he has his own lab. And when my cancer recurred, they were able to get a piece of tissue from my liver and compare that with my initial tumor. And he concluded that he's the one that found that my cancer is being driven by the RET mutation, which is, as I said, very rare. So I was the first patient from Mass General to be labeled, you know, as RET. So I'm kind of the guinea pig for everybody, which is fine.
That's good. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, it's all good. It's all good.
And you said you're one of two people on this clinical trial.
I am. Yes. Yes, my doctor in Boston found this clinical trial for me, which just happens to be in Jacksonville, Florida. There's a doctor at Baptist Regional Medical Center, and his thing is clinical trials. And a lot of the University of Florida oncology medical students train under him, but he's like the guru of clinical trials. He gets sought out by the pharmaceutical companies. So I've just been lucky in having people like that sorry about those dogs.
Oh, that's okay.
having people like that, you know, care for me.
That is amazing. And you could be like, for the breast cancer world, Annie Parker. You could be the Annie Parker for the lung cancer world.
Well, I hope so. Things are opening up. I'm talking to you, which is a good thing. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome.
And a pharmaceutical company actually did a documentary on me and flew me and my daughter to their national meeting.
Oh.
And so I was able to be presented there. At the end of the documentary, they visited me on two different occasions and just filmed, you know, what I did. I was working at the time. And so that reached out there, and a lot of it was very well received. And it was very gratifying to be able to address the audience. And a lot of the people came up to me afterwards and said that it inspired them to work even harder to, you know, help raise the awareness. So it's baby steps. I take every opportunity I can to spread the word.
Well, tell me more
about my story, because it is, you know, I'm going on 10 years now.
Yes, which is amazing. Tell me more about this documentary that was filmed about you, because I had no idea about this.
Well, it was for internal use only. You know, and I used to work in radio, so I'm careful to not drop names and things like that because of legality things. But this pharmaceutical company found out through Katie Brown, our dear friend and Energizer Bunny, about me, and they reached out to me and approached me with their idea, and that's how that all came about. There was me and a gentleman from California, and we were featured in this documentary. My part of it were three-minute segments of me with my friends, with my family. They were here over Thanksgiving, and so they filmed my family as we just do our thing. We're a very close-knit family. I have three children that all followed me to Florida, and so they spent the day with us on Thanksgiving, and they interviewed my kids and friends of mine, and their topic was, what's important about time? You know, what does time mean to you, type of thing. And it's very thought-provoking to have a question posed like that, because it's just so broad. But and then the film crew came back in the middle of December. The last 2 days I was at work, where I teach music, or I taught orchestra and chorus at a performing arts like magnet school. So they were there for our dress rehearsal and performance. And when I told the kids on the last day of school, we did a performance for the school, and I kept my students behind, and then I announced to them I wouldn't be coming back. And so it just made for an interesting little story about me. But the whole focus was how me as a stage 4 cancer patient, and I've been working up until December, and just because you're stage 4 doesn't mean you have a termination date stamped on you or a death sentence. There's a lot of experimental things, and the PD-1 immunotherapy is soon to be FDA approved, I'm told. So that's pretty much what the documentary was, and it was meant as a motivational tool for the audience at the National Oncology Meeting for this pharmaceutical company.
It must have been very gratifying to see the people at the pharmaceutical company realize that patients aren't just people out there. Because I know a lot of people, a lot of doctors who do their research and everything don't ever get to see the people that their research affects.
Well, that's true, and I've been fortunate enough where I have found, I sought out the specialists, or actually they kind of found me, because at Mass General, it's through a friend that happened to hear a news story on the television is how I found out that Mass General was seeking relatively young, otherwise healthy women who never smoked, and they were looking for people like me. So I had to go and qualify and get screened. There was a phone interview and an application and a lot of hoops to jump through, and I was accepted as a patient there, where they're, which is one of the places they're doing cutting edge research on lung cancer specifically. So I was fortunate enough to land there, and that's probably why I'm still around, because I've been able to be treated with proton beam therapy, and that wasn't even heard of 10 years ago. So, as I said, I'm kind of the guinea pig leading the charge.
That's awesome.
And that's good. That's a good thing.
So when do you see your, how often do you do your clinical trial?
Well, it's ongoing right now. I'm just they're learning from me. They're learning, you know, what the side effects are, and the eyes are on me, and the clinical trial nurse calls me often, and I get blood work tomorrow. I'm currently on a little bit of a break from the medication because they're trying to figure out dosages and that kind of thing.
Right. And it's always hard when you're the first. They have to figure all that out.
Right. Right. And they're figuring it out on me and one other person right now.
That's all right, though. You're
yes, it is.
You're the benchmark for which everyone else will be healed.
Well, I hope so. I truly hope so.
Now you, how many Hope Summits have you gone to? The national one, I mean.
Just last year was my first one. I didn't really know about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get hooked up with Katie and Longevity till last year, or 18 months ago maybe, and it was through another lung cancer patient that I don't even remember how he and I became connected. It was probably through social media, mm-hmm, or something like that, and then it was through him that I found out about longevity, and I've been a big fan ever since. So last year was my first one, and as I said, in 2 weeks there's going to be a regional summit that I'm attending here in Florida, and I'm planning on attending the national summit again this year.
So
it depends how things go with this clinical trial.
Right. So tell me about how that was, meeting all the survivors. And how many survivors were there at last year's Hope Summit?
Oh, my gosh. Now you're pinning me down.
Well, you can give me a round number, you know. Approximate.
Goodness gracious. I was looking at the picture on my computer. I'd say, Katie would know better, but would say at least 100.
100 people. Did you ever think
that
you would...
That's my guesstimate.
Did you ever think you would meet 100 lung cancer survivors in the same room?
No, I never really thought about it. Mm-hmm. And then when I did attend the summit, it struck me when Katie said that their first summit there were about what, a handful of people.
Right.
And it's grown exponentially since then to include all of us that were there.
Mm-hmm. Caregivers as well.
Yeah. It's very inspiring for us to meet each other.
Now, tell me, we were talking a little bit before the show about even you were getting, you're an advocate against lung cancer stigma. And even when you were diagnosed, you were like, well, I never smoked, so this can't be right. Tell me a little bit about how that affected you and how you go about, advocating and telling people, hey, it isn't just about if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer.
Right. Well, I've ran the gamut of emotions, and I just consider myself living on bonus time right now. So I deal with I understand, the people that are stuck, but I feel sad for them too, that are stuck in this angry phase where they get angered about the stigma. And maybe it's because I'm a teacher and maybe it's because I've been surviving this long and still am, that I've come to acknowledge the fact that people just don't know unless you tell them.
Right.
And what I do is, instead of getting angry, I use it as a teachable moment. Just in my everyday life and online, and I've written to, it's hard. It's really hard to get the word out, but I did have an article published in November in our local paper.
Awesome.
And I just do every opportunity that comes my way to spread the word. It's kind of like a grassroots type of thing. Is the way I look at it, because it's really hard. And I've sent emails to all the news outlets every year, and sometimes they pick up the story and sometimes they don't. But I've had news stories about me on the local news, like for Lung Cancer Awareness Month.
Right.
It's sporadic, but I just keep plogging away. And I think strides are being made. It's a slow process, but just as an example, I was getting my hair cut a couple days ago, and it was a new stylist. Well, actually, now that I have hair, it's been a while. And we, you chat with your hairstylist, and
right.
When it came up, she's the one that's said, you're probably one of the ones that never smoked.
Oh.
I said, you're absolutely right. So she had some background knowledge that lung cancer doesn't necessarily mean you smoked. So she already had heard that. And then, of course, I took it from there and started spouting off the statistics, which she wasn't aware of, like, you know what they
yes.
are. We all know what they are in the lung cancer community. So that's kind of what I did. And I had my students at school. I would be gone every, depending on my situation, on and off.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be going to Boston, and I would tell them, not over. Stated, but they knew what kind of that I had cancer. They knew I had lung cancer. I made sure they knew that I never smoked, and that reached a lot of people because parents, just networking.
And I think the other problem is even doctors don't get it about people smoking, because I've gone to a couple survivor sessions at the local hospital, and one of them was one of the top oncologists in this hospital was telling all the people in the room that they shouldn't smoke, and I really wanted to get up and be like, are you freaking kidding me right now that you're telling a group of survivors who are already in the process of either having chemo or a few years out that we shouldn't smoke? I mean, I don't think we're the demographic that you should be telling that to, first of all. And second of all, duh. I mean, I think we all know. We all know that we shouldn't smoke. And we all know that lung cancer isn't necessarily caused by smoking. And I actually had a radiologist send me emails at the same hospital about, well, no, you're wrong. Here are all the statistics that I have. Smoking causes lung cancer. And I was just like, my head was about to explode. It's like, no, you should come to DC and meet all the people who haven't smoked, the 20-year-olds, the 50-year-olds, however old you are. They've never smoked and they get lung cancer. I mean, the bottom line is if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer.
Right.
Same with every other cancer.
Right. And you bring up a very good point. It's alarming to me how many community oncologists still don't know about genetic testing for lung cancer. I think my oncologist, I happen to have a good local oncologist, mm-hmm. But I think he was quite relieved when I got into the hands of the specialist, the lung cancer specialist. And I'm a big proponent of mentoring people and telling them to seek out a specialist. That said, that's not always the case. People live in the middle of nowhere, and depending on where you live, and they don't have the resources to go to MD Anderson or Boston or one of these places or Stanford.
Right.
And the local, you're right. The local, a lot of local oncologists don't know what they don't know. And they're dealing with a plethora of cancers. You know, you name it, they have to deal with it.
Right.
And as I said, there's a lot of patients and people that I talk to that I'll say, well, has your tumor been tested for genetic mutation? Have they been genotyped? And they say, well, my doctor never said anything about that, you know, and I counsel them and say, you need to ask them mm-hmm. to test your tumors. So that's what's alarming to me is the fact that there's a lot of doctors that don't know.
Well, and I also think some
lung cancer.
Some doctors may think it might be financially not financially viable for some people, but I think that the patient should be made aware of any tests, even if it is financially viable for them or not. Because there's always a way to figure it out. I mean, you know, pay it off later, whatever. I mean, I got the breast cancer has the BRCA1, BRCA2 test, and I had that, and that was before the whole landmark trial against whatever the company was that wanted to patent the gene. You know, they wanted to patent the breast cancer gene so they could, Myriad was a company, so they could make all the money off this testing. And it's like, well, you can't patent a gene that's in like people, you know. So fortunately for breast cancer survivors and ovarian cancer survivors, the tests, they were ruled incorrect, and other people can do this test now. Now it's cheaper than $3,000, but when I had it, it was $3,000, and a lot of people may not have gotten it, and may not have mm-hmm. gotten it because of that. But I think, you know, no matter what the cost is, I mean, it's your health. There's no amount of money that you can put on that.
Exactly. Exactly. I really do strongly encourage everyone that I talk with or am in contact with mm-hmm. to seek out a specialist in the field.
Or even just someone like you. If someone is not sure.
Someone that's been there, done that. Yeah.
Exactly. Someone who's been there, done that. You know, I always tell people, I'm not going to give you medical advice. I'm going to give you my opinion because I'm not a doctor.
Exactly.
But you can say, you know what? I had genetic testing. This might be good for you. And if they're unsure of it or if they've never heard of it, then they can make their own rational decisions. If sometimes, like you said, your doctor may not know everything that you've researched online, or like you said, an advocate that you know has researched online, it's always good to have a second person to be like, hey, well, what about this? And if your doctor is kind of hesitant about it, about genetic testing, and you still want to do it, then you need to find another doctor.
Exactly. And it's funny you mentioned online, and, you know, everybody's free to do what they want, but my doctors, both of my oncologists, have said to me, don't go online.
Right. Don't self-diagnose. I understand.
Don't go online. There's a lot of misinformation there, too. So either that's a personal choice, but you can drive yourself crazy trying to research things online.
Well, I think one good thing my doctor told me that I didn't listen to is right when you're diagnosed, do not go online and look up your disease. Like take a little bit, because I did, and it's like you see the list of side effects and you see the list of things that could happen, and then you all of a sudden, like, your head explodes with everything, like, oh my God, I have this and that, and, you know, suddenly you have malaria and you've never been to Africa. You know what I mean? It's
right. And
researching is good.
Then there's all the misinformation about alternative treatments and all that kind of
stuff. Exactly.
I think that's real good advice that your doctor gave
That I didn't listen to. Because then my fiance was like, didn't she tell you not to look? I'm like, yes. I mean, but that's another thing. I mean, your doctor says don't look online, but, you know, I mean, you're smart enough to make, you know, you can make your own choices and make your own decisions. If you think the natural way to go is your way, then that's fine. But I think you should also get more than one opinion if that's what you were going for.
Exactly.
And like
take out the specialists and
the advocates.
Yeah.
Because
you have to advocate for yourself. I've had the benefit of experience here, bumbling my way through these years.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also been fortunate to find the specialists and the doctors. And we kind of found each other in some instances. So I'm, as I said, you know, on the clinical trial, I'm a big believer in clinical trials. This is just like the third clinical trial I've been on in my cancer journey.
Well, that's good. I mean, you're still groundbreaking. You're still on the forefront of that. You know?
And research is starting to catch up, and people are starting to take note.
But really, because
it's still underfunded, and the survival rates have remained unchanged since the 80s, where, like, for example, breast cancer, there's like an 80% survival rate now. But for lung cancer, it remains 15%.
Well, here's my thing about that. They say breasts are sexy, but it's, you know, think about you walking and taking a deep breath. If you can't take a deep breath, that's not sexy. You know, you can't do anything without your lungs.
The funny thing about me personally, my situation is I have no cancer in my lungs. It's my lungs are clear. My mine stays contained in my liver now.
Oh.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird. This half hour went pretty fast. If cancer survivors want to get a hold of you, or caregivers want to get a hold of you, where can they do so?
They could email me, mkrause, C-R-O-U-S-E, at embarkmail, and that's embarkmail.com.
Okay, and you're also on Facebook.
Yes, I'm on Facebook.
So that's an easy way to find you.
That's an easy way. I'm on several groups on Facebook. That might even be better.
Okay, on Facebook, and then you can also contact Katie Brown, and she can always hook you up with other survivors
as well. That's right. She's a she's a good person.
And your dogs want to be involved in the interview, too. That's okay. I've had dogs and everything like that. We're almost done here. If I can wrap up like I usually do. This is Mel Majerus. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie. Check out my new website, thecancerwarrior.net. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's the Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.